6 weeks after she was appointed. Also in Britain, a public inquiry finds that child sex abuse is an epidemic in Britain affecting millions of victims. And the EU imposes new sanctions against Iran over alleged supply of drones to Russia in the Ukraine war.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss says she is resigning as Prime Minister. This after tumultuous 6 weeks into her job that included financial market chaos and the replacement of two of her most senior ministers.
I recognise, though, given the situation, I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Truss said a leadership election will be completed within the next week. She said that she would stay on as Prime Minister until a successor is chosen to serve as Tory leader. The end for Truss came after a key minister resigned and many Tory lawmakers rebelled over an important vote in a chaotic scene at the House of Commons late Wednesday. By Thursday morning, more than a dozen Conservative lawmakers had publicly urged Truss to resign. Media speculation say Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt, two of the contenders in the previous leadership contest this year, are believed to be running for prime minister, but Labour leader Keir Starmer says an immediate general election is required. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Saeed Puraza, live from London. Saeed, thank you very much. If you could please shed more light on the different aspects of this whole situation. On the one hand, we have the Labour leader who is saying that there should be an immediate general election. Then there's the Tory party, which apparently is going to choose the next prime minister. What exactly can we expect to happen?
Well, as far as general election, it's not certain that it's going to happen anytime soon, at least not until next year, based on what I'm hearing. The Labour opposition can call for an election, but it's not going to happen. But the way to do it would be to force what they call a confidence vote. And to do that, it'll have to be canvassing or recruiting the support of the MPs on the opposite side, which is members of the Conservative Parliamentary Party, for that to take place. Now, as far as the candidates who have thrown their hats into the ring, you mentioned the runner-up in the previous leadership contest, Rishi Sunak, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Finance Minister, and also Penny Mordaunt, who was also a contestant in the previous round. I think she finished third, and now she's the leader of the House of Commons. But wait for this. Boris Johnson, the former prime minister who had to resign in ignominy, is also said to be throwing his hat into the ring, running for the top job. But whether or not he'll do that is not really certain yet, particularly because with a return of a comeback of Johnson, you're going to look at all those problems that forced him out of number 10 come back as well. Plus, he has that so-called Privileges Committee that has been investigating whether or not he misled Parliament when he said that all the rules had been abided by when the allegations of COVID parties, rule-breaking parties, taking place at his residence in number 10 emerged back then. So you have those names, and again, Johnson's name as well at the same time. But a general election, as I say, is not likely to happen. The other question is that whether or not members of the Conservative Party will be able to rally around a favorite candidate. Yes, Rishi Sunak is the front runner, so it seems. But again, this is a very divided party, as you know. Things that Liz Truss has done, Trussonomics is now a word that a lot of us will remember. As a result of Trussonomics and over the past 6 weeks, the damage that her economic ideology, her fiscal plan or economic plan has done to the Conservative Party, to the economy here, and to the currency, the country's currency, will be long-lasting, and the party, the country, will be reeling from that economic decision for years to come. But as I say, it's not going to be easy for this very divided party that is deeply damaged to be able to support one candidate and introduce that candidate to take over as prime minister by Friday next week and prepare him or her for Monday. That's when Jeremy Hunt, the new chancellor of the Exchequer, will have to come out with that detailed economic plan. Add to that, of course, at the same time, we'll be hearing from the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility, that will give an assessment of what the UK economy will look like down the line. But it is going to be very difficult to find that candidate and also to get the votes of the Tory Conservative Party membership. How is it going to be done in a matter of 1 week? That's also a very important question. Probably via mail. You're looking at 160, if not more, to some accounts, 190,000 Conservative Party members who will have to vote for the candidates that will be introduced. Now, that could be only one candidate picked by the parliamentary party to be only confirmed by the Conservative Party membership, or two or three from among the people who will be running for the top job for the keys to number 10 Downing Street. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Saeed Pureza, keeping a close eye on the developments in London. Moving on. A seven-year inquiry into child sexual abuse in Britain has published its findings. It says that the issue has become a, quote, epidemic in the UK. According to the findings, in any group of 200 children, 40 would be victims before the age of 16. The figures also show the age of victims is going down, with a 45% rise in offences in recent years against those under four. The report says religious and political bodies have covered up allegations to protect the perpetrators. The abuse involved children, babies and toddlers, and was often accompanied by extreme violence and acts of sadism. The independent inquiry into child sexual abuse was set up in 2014 following a series of horrific revelations of abuse involving celebrities and political figures. The European Union unveils a new set of sanctions targeting Iran over allegations that it has been supplying drones to hit Russia to hit Ukraine. In a tweet, the Czech presidency of the EU has announced that the bloc will take restrictive measures against entities supplying Iranian drones to Russia to be used in the Ukraine war. The tweet also says that EU member states have decided to freeze the assets of three individuals and one entity responsible for drone deliveries to Moscow. Iran has dismissed, quote, baseless allegations about providing Russia with weapons and drones to be used in the war in Ukraine. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says while Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, it is not Tehran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. He made these remarks in a phone call with the EU Vice President Joseph Borrell. Amir Abdullahian reminded Borrell that Tehran is against the war and any escalation of conflict. He said Iran has been clear and consistent in its stance on the Ukraine war. Meanwhile, Russia says the West is trying to pressure Tehran with accusations that Moscow is using drones from Iran in Ukraine.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Moscow has repeatedly dismissed Western reports that Iran has been supplying it with drones. It says any drone it uses is Russian-made. In the meantime, Tehran has already said that it is ready for talks with Ukraine to clear things up. Iran has called for an end to the Ukraine war using self-restraint on both sides.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days.
Kiev and some of its Western backers accuse Iran of supplying Russia with Gerson-2 drones. Ukraine claims Russia has acquired as many as 2,400 of these UAVs, and the West accuses Iran of breaching a UN resolution that placed an arms embargo on Tehran. The embargo expired in 2020 despite Washington's efforts to renew the measure.
The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed-136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
A new report by the U.S. Central Bank says the country's economic prospects are becoming, quote, more pessimistic. The Federal Reserve says economic activity has slowed down and demand is weak due to rising interest rates and high inflation and supply disruptions. The Fed added that recession fears have also spread in several districts. The Federal Reserve has already raised the interest rate 5 times since March to tame inflation and avoid a possible recession. The bank says more interest rates hikes are on the way and the U.S. inflation has reached a 40-year high of more than 8%. Households are grappling with soaring costs of living worsened by supply chain problems and skyrocketing energy prices due to the war in Ukraine. Ethnic clashes in Sudan's southern state of Blue Nile have left at least 150 people dead in 2 days. New clashes were triggered in the wake of an ongoing land dispute between members of the Hausa people and rival groups. The fight has centered around Wad al-Mahi, some 500 kilometers south of the capital, Khartoum. Fighting between the Hausa people and other groups first broke out in July with more than 200 dead and injured. According to the UN, some 65,000 people have been forced from homes amid clashes in the region. Sudan is grappling with deepening political unrest and economic crisis since last year's military coup led by the army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The crisis-hit European Union, which is now desperate, has now resorted to its former colony, Algeria, to make a deal on gas. Whether it will be successful or not is a question which is answered in the opinion editorial published in Russia Today website. Stay with us for more of the opinion editorial of Russia Today. Faced with an energy crisis, France turns to a former colony that might not be too eager to rekindle an abusive relationship. Just a year ago, French President Emmanuel Macron could hardly bother to give the former North African French colony the time of day. It was mostly taken for granted that Algiers would keep pumping gas for the European Union as the bloc's third largest natural gas supplier after Russia and Norway. Emmanuel Macron even accused the country's political military system of inciting hatred towards France. He went as far as to ask, "Was there an Algerian nation before French colonization? That's the question," he said. Sounds a lot like the rhetoric someone hears when they're in an exploitative relationship. "You were nothing before I came along and started taking advantage of you. But now that the European Union is undergoing an acrimonious divorce from former natural gas main squeeze, Russia, its tune has surely changed." This week, the French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, headed to Algeria with 16 French ministers for an economic cooperation trip. Increased gas supplies for France were not on the table, according to her office. Guess she is waiting until the third date, like a gentleman, before jumping all over Algeria's gas. But the moment could be coming up fast, since the country's first date with its new French charmers was with Emmanuel Macron himself just 6 weeks ago. He didn't mention gas at the time, but the fact that he showed up on the date with the chief executive officer of the Paris-headquartered energy multinational, Engie, hinted at his real interest. Similarly, the European Union Energy Commissioner was just expected to attend a conference in the country during the French delegation's trip. Officially, the French wooing of Algiers is all about reconciliation and making amends. "Sorry, I ignored you and took advantage of your kindness earlier. How about giving me a chance? I've changed. Of course, Europe has indeed changed." It's now knocking on the doors worldwide in an effort to shake free from new gas supplies and as its economy starts buckling under spiking energy prices, energy rationing and blackout threats. And fall has barely even begun, let alone winter. For an idea of just how bad things are, last week, the French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, held a press conference to introduce an energy sobriety plan for all sectors of French daily life, from businesses and sports to housing, industry and public services. Sobriety is a simple concept, savings chosen rather than cuts suffered, said Borne. "Depending on our consumption and the weather, we will then know if we are progressing at the right pace and in the right direction. The French government, like others across Europe, has already set heating and cooling limits. In France, someone going over the 19 degrees Celsius temperature for their home could theoretically risk a €1,500 fine under the French Penal Code and €3,000 in the case of repeat offenders. But unfortunately for Europe, Algiers has long maintained an officially non-aligned position and doesn't sound too keen on throwing itself totally and exclusively into the arms of Europe and the West, particularly now that it has other options to diversify its interests in an increasingly multipolar world. To that end, it has strengthened bilateral cooperation with China and its historical ally Russia, which helped it gain its independence from France, as it has every right to do so. Further complicating France and the European Union's seduction efforts is its meddling stepmom, America, who doesn't like that Algeria has ties with Russia and seems to want to nip in the bud any deepening EU-Algerian relationship. To that end, the United States is now considering sanctioning Algeria for a $7 billion weapons deal with Moscow that was inked last year. Surely, it's purely coincidental that it's only now that Europe is increasingly showing up on Algeria's doorstep with flowers that these sanctions threats are suddenly materializing. Any country continuing to support Russia as it relates to the conflict in Ukraine right now, its unjust and its unlawful infringement on Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty would be deeply problematic, said U.S. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesman Vedant Patel. When asked to comment on a bipartisan letter demanding sanctions against Algerian government officials sent by members of Congress to the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, any such sanctions wouldn't just hit Algeria. Wherever the EU's economic diversification away from United States dependence goes, sanctions seem to follow. Such was the case with Iran and the bloc's gas supply from Russia through the new Nord Stream 2 pipeline, for example. And it all comes at a time when some European leaders are starting to make noises suggesting the United States is taking advantage of the European Union's increased dependence on US natural gas in the wake of sanctioning its supply from Russia. Some countries, some of which are considered friends, partially charge astronomic prices. Germany's economy minister, Robert Habeck, said in an interview earlier this month. Robert Habeck added, "The United States approached us when oil prices were high, leading to a release of national oil reserves also in Europe. I think this kind of solidarity would also work well for lowering gas prices. Good luck with that begging as a strategy until the European Union stops letting Washington call the shots and meddle in its relationships. It's never going to be able to find true happiness and prosperity with Algeria or with anyone else."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
As was announced, the topic that inshallah I will be covering will be the cultivation of an Islamic identity in a postmodern era. It's a fancy title to talk about identity, essentially. Before I get into a little bit of the muqaddamat and the preliminary discussions tonight, I do want to speak a little bit about the importance of these days and delivering the right message. There's a very powerful hadith by Imam Jawad alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala. Let's keep this hadith in mind when we do actually venture out and give our time to various speakers. The hadith says, "Man asgha ila natiqan faqad abadahu." For the one now who does asgha. Asgha, for lack of a better translation, is the one who listens attentively and attempts to follow what he or she has heard. Ila natiqan, from the natiq. Natiq, of course, here means a speaker. The one who listens and follows a speaker, faqad abadahu, becomes the servant or slave of that speaker. Now, of course, I'm not talking about worshipping that speaker, but I'm talking about impact. I'm talking about the fact that there is influence there from a speaker. The hadith goes on very dangerously now. Imam Jawad breaks down the various different levels. He says, فَإِنْ كَانَ نَاطِقًا عَنِ اللَّهِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ اللَّهِ. If the natiq, if the speaker now speaks from Allah, for Allah, on behalf of Allah, takes the audience and the awam and the majma' towards Allah, فَقَدْ عَبَدَ اللَّهِ, they become the slaves of Allah. وَإِنْ كَانَ نَاطِقًا يَنْتِقُ إِلَى لِسَانِ إِبْلِيسِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ إِبْلِيسِ. But if that speaker, if that natiq speaks from the lisan of Iblis, from the tongue and the lahja of shaitan, presents satanic concepts on this member, meant to divide the nation, destroy homes, cut the knees of another speaker or an alim, go against the maraji', basically satanic concepts, then the people who are listening to them, who does what? Remember, man asgha. There are a lot of people, a lot of us, who not only follow lectures, but we follow certain individuals. And after a while, we begin to worship them like idols. That whatever they say is hujjat upon us for some reason. Whether it goes against a certain concept in Islam or not, but the hadith is very dangerous. If that natiq, if that speaker is speaking in a satanic lahja, in a satanic tone, then the audience, فَقَدْ عَبَدَ Iblis, becomes a slave of Iblis. It's dangerous. I have my rights that all of you have to give me as my audience, to sit quietly, listen to me. But one thing I don't think is ever mentioned is that you also have rights. As the listener, as the one who now takes time out of their day, there are some couples here tonight who have brought in their newborn baby in a car seat. You know how hard that is? To get them ready, to leave, to pack the bags. You bring children now, they get home by the time I get home, it'll be midnight. My kids were fast asleep in the car last night. It is a sacrifice. It's a movement. It's not easy. Now, for you to come and listen to satanic concepts on the minbar is injustice done to you as the awam and the speaker. Which means that you also have to ensure the rights that you have are upheld by the one sitting on this very minbar. Because, this is, in the world of Arabic grammar, a minbar is an Arabic word that is ismi makan. It is a place where we should be gaining elevation. It's a place of bulandi, as they say in Urdu. Which is why when you look at the way that our fourth imam now directs and addresses Yazid in his own courtyard, he never refers to what he's sitting on as a minbar. Takhti chubi, he says, as you say in Farsi. It's a wooden plank this man is sitting on, because there's no way what he's sitting on is a minbar of Rasul. There's no bulandi and there's no elevation coming from someone like that. Not to further fuel them. To address those issues that are mubtala bih, as they say, that are directly hitting our homes, our community, our ummah at large. And unfortunately, I only have 10 days. And there is an umpteen amount of issues to talk about. It's my discretion as a speaker now to figure out what is it that I need to address. And one thing that has come to my attention for many, many years is this crisis of an identity. You ask my elders, where are you from, what are you, who are you? Right away the answer is there. You ask these kids, where are you from? They'll say, what do you want to know? My parents? Where I was born? Where I grew up? What language I know? Right? 10 more questions follow that. So it is the job of the speaker on the pulpit now to ensure that those issues are addressed. Otherwise there's no point, I'm sorry. And I mentioned that because you might think, well, this is obvious, Asad Bhai. It's not so obvious anymore. And so this is a massive topic, and one that I think that we have to identify. Islam has its own identity. And the problem is that our youth are not sold on that identity. And so they are looking now to be accepted and attach themselves to something where now they feel like they belong. Remember, inside the psyche of the human being, inside the innate nature of the human being, is a sense of belongingness. They need to belong to something. This tribalism that we've seen from the Prophet's time, even today, is very innate. But that's what it is. It is an innate gravitational pull. Allah says we did that, right? إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ ذَكْرٍ وَأُنْثَى وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلًا. We placed you in tribes. It's fitri not to belong to each other. Right? It's fitri not to have this sense of belongingness. And the moment that the youth of today feel like they don't belong to a community, to a family, to an identity, they'll go out shopping for something else. I always talk about this in my tarbiyat classes whenever I talk about bringing up children. If you want your kids to be attached inside your home, it's not my topic, but very briefly, if you want them to stay at home and be invested in that family, make them feel like they belong in that family. How do I do that? You acknowledge their existence. We have some parents, unfortunately, that the moment that a child begins to talk, they get cut off, they get shushed. Tum bas khamosh raho, tum chote ho, you have no idea what's going on, you're young. You know, meanwhile, he's a 21-year-old grown man, full beard. What do you know? Tum to bachi ho, you have no idea. And right away, khamosh, khamosh, quiet, 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 silence, silence, and automatically now he feels that I don't belong in this tribe. And so they go around shopping for different tribes. And sometimes I tell you, the best of your kids belong to the worst of the groups. Because I know they're wrong, I know they're bad, Asad Bhai, but they make me feel like I belong to them. The moment you identify with anybody, you attach yourself to that. And that comes from an innate nature to be known. We want to be known. The moment somebody doesn't acknowledge my presence is the moment that I feel like I'm invisible. The worst thing you could do to anybody, be it your own child, is make them feel invisible in front of you. They're talking, no one's listening. They walk into this hall, they say salam to every single person, they avoid you. The second person comes, doesn't say salam to you. The third doesn't, everyone else they say salam to, but they walk right past you. After all, you have to say, hello, am I invisible? Do you not see me? So this is a crisis right now. I don't think a lot of our youth feel like they belong to the tribe of Islam. They identify with Islam. Because with identity comes a lot of beautiful characteristics. One of them is pride. There's nothing more beautiful for me than to see a young kid, 10, 12, 13, 15, that's proud to be a Muslim. That stops and says, no, my name is Muhammad, not Muhammad. It's Ali, not Ali. You can do it. Say it with me. Oh, I tried very hard to get Asad. I got Assad, I'll take that. But Assad, I couldn't take. No, say it properly. That's all part of the pride factor. Because the flip side is that if you don't identify with the deen, then any remnant of the deen inside of you, from the physical hijab, to the beard, to the name on your business card, all will not resemble Islam. We run from that as far as possible. This is a crisis we're facing right now.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Economic inflation is continuing in America and prices move faster than the increase in salaries of employees and workers in this country. Problems in the supply chain, the war in Ukraine and high demand for consumers have kept the prices of goods in the United States at the highest level in the past 40 years. In a report, CNN says inflation is rampant in the United States and the central bank's tool to fight price increases is to set higher interest rates. This makes borrowing more expensive and slows down the U.S. economy. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us for more. The New York Post writes, an analysis from the Heritage Foundation showed the average American has lost $4,200 in annual income since President Joe Biden took office. Experts at the conservative think tank said in a recent report the losses come down to surging inflation and higher interest rates. Their analysis found that the average American has lost about $3,000 in annual purchasing power because consumer prices, which have risen 12.7% since January of 2021, have spiked significantly faster than wages. Wages have risen just 8% over the same period, which has effectively resulted in a pay cut for Americans struggling to pay for daily necessities, including food, gas, and rent. Higher interest rates and borrowing costs have also reduced the average person's purchasing power by another $1,200. E.J. Anthony, a research fellow in regional economics with the Heritage Foundation's Center for Data Analysis, says, simply put, working Americans are $4,200 poorer today than when Joe Biden took office. He added, this financial catastrophe for American families is a direct result of a president and Congress addicted to spending our money, combined with a Federal Reserve compliantly enabling this addiction by printing more dollars. E.J. Anthony added, now the U.S. Federal Reserve is finally fighting inflation, which is pushing up interest rates and increasing financial costs. Rates on all kinds of consumer debt are rising. Mortgage interest rates have doubled since Joe Biden took office, greatly increasing Americans' monthly payments. Concerns about persistent inflation were renewed recently when U.S. Federal Reserve data showed consumer prices had increased 8.3% in August compared to the same month 1 year earlier, a figure that was worse than what economists had been expecting. The British newspaper The Guardian explains more about the same issue. US Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell warned recently that there would be pain ahead as the U.S. central bank struggles to contain a surge in inflation unseen in the past 40 years. The U.S. Federal Reserve announced another sharp rise in interest rates on Wednesday afternoon, 21st of September, after the conclusion of its meeting. It also updated its economic forecast for the U.S. economy. Economists said the Fed raised its benchmark interest rate by 0.75 percentage points, the third such rise in a row, and plans to raise interest rates again in the coming months. The interest hike comes as central banks around the world are increasing rates to tackle a soaring cost of living crisis. Last year, the U.S. Federal Reserve dismissed inflation as a transitory issue triggered by the pandemic and supply chain issues. But consumer prices have remained stubbornly high and have remained so despite a change in the U.S. Federal Reserve's view and its aggressive interest rate rises. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced recently that prices were 8.3% higher last month compared with August of last year. The U.S. Federal Reserve's target rate for inflation is 2% annually. That news has led some to speculate that the U.S. Federal Reserve could increase interest rates by a full percentage point, a drastic move for an institution that usually moves interest rates cautiously up and down by a quarter of a percentage point. The sharp rise in the interest rates are aimed at slowing the economy and bringing down prices. Higher interest rates have fed through to the housing market, where rates for a 30-year mortgage have now passed the 6% mark for the first time in the past 14 years. Until recently, Jerome Powell had suggested a soft landing was possible for the U.S. economy, in which rising interest rates would bring down prices without causing a severe financial downturn. But at the annual meeting of the central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, last month, Jerome Powell acknowledged that economic distress was a price the U.S. Federal Reserve was willing to pay to control inflation. He said, "While higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to American households and businesses. These are the unfortunate costs of reducing inflation, but a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain." Moreover, The Hill reported U.S. markets are bottoming out as they process the latest interest rate hikes from the U.S. Federal Reserve in its battle to fight high inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 500 points to hit 29,590 at market close on Friday, 24th of September, its lowest point in nearly 2 years. Since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising interest rates in March, the index has lost more than 13% of its value and is down more than 19% on the year. Other indices have followed suit. The Standard & Poor's 500 fell 65 points to close at 3,693 on Friday, down more than 15% since last March and almost 23% on the year. The technology-heavy Nasdaq index dropped nearly 200 points, or 1.8%, to close at 10,867, down almost 20% since last March. Interest rates have also increased to 3.25 percentage points since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising them from 0% last March. This has had the effect of making many goods and services more expensive and driving down demand to bring down inflation. We'll be right back. Meanwhile, an opinion poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows the vast majority of the American public are dissatisfied with the state of the economy. According to the findings, around 29% of U.S. adults say the economy is in good shape, and 71% say it is doing poorly. The pollsters also revealed that only 27% of the American public are content with the economic and political course taken by the administration of President Joe Biden, while 72% say things are going in the wrong direction. Commenting on the survey results, the researchers noted concerns about President Joe Biden's handling of the economy persist. Only 38% of the American public approve of Biden's economic leadership, while 53% disapprove of the way he has dealt with raging inflation. According to the opinion poll, the vast majority of the American public are concerned about domestic problems rather than foreign policy issues. The top five concerns are the rate of inflation, which jumped to 8.3% in the month of August, the state of the economy, the state of jobs, gun control, abortion, and soaring gasoline prices.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. A prayerful community means one which in its daily life distances itself from the leaders of corruption, those upon whom is Allah's wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ And those who follow corruption, those who are astray, ضَالِّين The Qur'an, Surah 1, verse 7. This is what prayer means. Another of the meanings of to maintain the prayer could be to create a society like this. Then the Qur'an says, And spend out of what we have provided them. What is the next mark of the faithful? That they give to others out of the provision we have given them. What does spending infaq mean? You will recall I discussed this in the previous lecture. Infaq means to fill a gap or to meet a need. Therefore, it only refers to those kinds of spending which fill gaps or meet needs. They say the meaning of infaq is this. Just as if the wall of this mosque is already painted, but you come and spend money having it painted again. This is not infaq. Why? Because there was no need to do this. It was already painted. Or even if it was not painted, there was no need to do so. If you come and paint the earth around the Imam Hassan Mosque and say, we spent our wealth on the Imam Hassan Mosque. We took several crates of paint to the mosque and used them there. What have you actually done? You've painted some clods of earth and some dust. Yes, you've spent some money, but this is not what Allah means by infaq.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Infaq means to spend for the sake of closing gaps that need to be filled in the fabric of society and fulfilling actual needs, not just spending for the sake of spending. What does "and spend out of what we have provided them" mean? It means that true believers are those who give out of whatever Allah has given them. This doesn't just mean money. Does Allah say "and spend out of the money we have provided them"? No. Allah draws no distinction between the wealth He has given them, the life He has given them, the children He has given them, the dignity He has given them, the physical strength He has given them, the power of speech which He has given them, and the mind and ideas He has given them. So, what we have provided them includes all of the abilities and resources that Allah has placed at their disposal. And what do the truly faithful do with the things Allah has provided them? They spend out of them. They do infaq. In other words, they spend it where it is needed, not haphazardly. This is one of the marks of the true believer.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.